call the House Committee on Health Care to order and open a room. Before I do, I want to warn everybody, we've got a tight schedule today and we want to get through it. We're getting toward the end of how we can handle House bills. So I will expect to spend about 15 minutes or so on each hearing, hoping to leave 45 minutes for work on 3137. We'll see how that goes. So I'm going to ask all of us who are testifying, including me on one of my bills, to be brief, succinct, and powerful in our testimony. And we'll start with that opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2899 and invite Representative Kennemore to kick us off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, our committee member at the moment. My name is Bill Kennemore. I'm a state representative from Oregon City, Canby area. And I'm here this morning, or this afternoon, to talk about House Bill 2899. There's a little bit of history, and some of us who have some institutional memory take this back a while. Actually, the Oregon Lottery was substantially introduced during my term in the Senate, which ranged from 87 through 96. And one of the things that happened was we expanded it several times, and one of those expansions was to the area of video poker. And in point of fact, as a point of history, I voted against that expansion, feeling like, there's a balance in public good. And part of what was of interest to me at the time was that there was an agreement that there would be no advertising on television of video poker. The other games, fine, but not video poker. As you know, in this last recession, as lottery proceeds went down, that rule was not followed, and there was advertising on TV about video poker. And I think that violated an understanding that was from the origin of implementing it. There's some probably legally justifiable, but I take some exception to actions like that. And I would note that I've met with the lottery officials since then, and they've indicated that they have decided to withdraw that kind of advertising and do not anticipate doing it in the future, which obviates some of the necessity of this bill. However, I think that part of the reason I want to talk about this bill and have this bill before us is I think it's important for the legislature to think about its addiction to video poker, because it's the major producer of lottery proceeds. And we spend those money with vigor, and they go mostly to good causes. I don't argue that. But they come and go at an extreme expense. I'd like to give you an example. It happens to be a personal one. This last as the recession was getting underway and video poker was starting to be advertised, my stepson lost his job. He had a mediocre paying job and had great difficulty finding a new job, and frankly was quite traumatized by the loss of his job, the unexpected loss of his job, and the difficulty of trying to find a job. And the next thing I know is I find out he's going to the local tavern and playing video poker because he doesn't have enough money and he thinks he's lucky. Well, he wasn't very lucky. I don't really know. He never fessed how much, and frankly, I ask because I am kind of an intrusive kind of stepfather. But several thousand dollars went into the lottery proceeds, I would suspect, from someone who really could not afford to do that, but who was desperate. And part of that desperation, I think, was fed by advertising. I mean, advertising works. That's why we do it. And I think when we try to balance public policy and good decisions, I think that was the original reason we weren't going to do this. A couple of other things about it, more to the point, is I think as we're going, and I appreciate, incidentally, Mr. Chairs, your bringing this topic up. I think we need to have a firm discussion about our addiction as a legislature to video proceeds and its impact on our families. Our families, our Oregon citizens. It's really interesting. There aren't apparently current statistics, and I've gotten a number of different ones, and perhaps Representative Kotek, who will come later, will have something better. But the latest numbers that I was able to derive for statistics on addiction, gambling addiction in Oregon, is roughly 77,500 people. 77,500 people. And it could be as high as 140, depending on who you want to use their estimates. But what this means is really something very specific. The vast majority of these people are addicted to Oregon video poker. And when I say video poker, the video games, I guess I should be saying. At least 56,000 of those are addicted to our games. Our games. 56,000 people. Now you need to multiply that times the sphere of influence in their families and the impact that it has on those families. It's astronomical. I find it interesting to sit and watch some of these video players, and incidentally, I'm not anti-gambling. I buy megabucks. I usually cannot resist it when it gets over $50 million. I love it.
Feeling lucky, right?
I don't usually feel lucky, but God, would I hate to miss it if I were. And I'm just thinking, you know, $50 million or more, that's enough to really do something. So it's fun to take that chance, but I can afford to do it. And I usually spend seldom ever more than a dollar, sometimes two. I get one for my wife and me, or I get one for a family member. But I think we need to stay focused on the fact that this is destroying lots of families. And we've also read the newspaper. In my local area, over $200,000 was embezzled for gambling debts.
$1.4 million, I think, in Westland. I'd have to double-check
in Westland. In Representative Parrish's district, an individual who worked for the city. Out in Estacada in the fire district, $35,000 was embezzled. And each one of us, I think, if we just remember, there have been examples of embezzlement. So I think this is something that we need to deal with, our addiction, and we need to deal with the fact that this needs to be reined in. And when you think about it, you know, when over 70 to 80% of those people that are addicted to gambling are addicted to our games, not the Indian casino games, not the others, and not to illegal gambling, but to ours. I think the responsibility rests with us. I think we need to stop exploiting the public and damaging families all throughout the state. But even in one final note, in theory, 1% of lottery proceeds are supposed to be for gambling addictions and other related problems. And incidentally, I don't blame the Lottery Commission. I blame the legislature. We have not been fulfilling that commitment. That money would make some difference. Now, I think we need to curb the games, but we also need to treat the problem. Frankly, it's not an easily treated problem, but there are treatments, and they do work. And we do have families that would be willing, typically after a disastrous situation, I might add, willing to get treatment. We ought to be providing it, and we ought to be providing it at the 1% that was promised. How's that?
Question, yes.
I apologize for being late and tied up in another meeting. Do you know where we are? We have a fund that for gambling addiction treatment. Do you know where we are in that fund balance?
You know, I apologize. I have a pretty valid excuse. So I've been out on
this issue. This is some
I didn't
time
get my research we've got the lottery director coming up shortly.
Okay. Yeah, some time ago, I remember seeing a news article that there was actually a pretty healthy fund balance there, and that we were collecting more money than we were treating addiction, which might be another part of the problem. But I don't recall the exact. I could be off, but okay. It's just something I think we need to talk about.
Well, and I know Representative Kotek and also. Representative from Milwaukee will be having things to say about this.
Follow up?
Oh.
Yes.
If we were not to do this and the companion bills, but discuss with and compel the health authority to take some action in the interim to organize something universal, would that be a solution? Do we have to have a statute on this, or if we could bring in a couple of people, a couple of rubber hoses, you know, and have a discussion about the need for this and then take it on as a committee sort of thing between now and next session? I'm not questioning whether we need it or not. I'm not sure the statute is the way to get what we need.
Mr. Chair, let me respond to that, and I appreciate that question. I think certainly, and I don't wish to speak regarding the other bills we're going to look at. Let ask that question of those. I think that's probably far preferable to my simple ban. And part of it is just what happened here. Let's talk about this.
Yes.
Let's put
yeah.
some sunshine on it.
Right.
And let's deal with this. I mean, 56,000 Oregonians.
Yeah.
I mean, that's 150,000 conservatively, probably 200,000 or 300,000 people dramatically impacted. I mean, 300,000 out of 3.5 million is what? I mean, you start doing the numbers, it ought to scare the daylights out of all of us.
Let's hear the three.
Yes.
Think
yeah.
about whether we can figure out an interim solution or whether we want to do something. Yes, ma'am.
Well, quick, thank you. Quick question. Do you have any data, and I'm sure we could dig it if you don't have it, because I'll give you all the grace you need for being out last week. But, you know, how much money we bring in to the lottery, particularly from this video poker piece, against how much money we're spending in the criminal justice system as a result? Well, you've talked about the addiction piece. I could tell you some horror stories about the criminal justice side of this, and so I'm kind of right there. You're preaching to the choir on this one for me. Do we have some correlation of, you know, yes, we got the $1.4 million in my city around gambling addiction. Now I'm talking about I've taken your credit card, and I'm taking it to the local wherever to go play these games, and the state collects the money, and then turns around and reallocates the money to the Department of Corrections.
I don't have those numbers at this point. And I also think public assistance and shelters, because this often leads to abuse and other family issues. I mean, this gets to be a big problem. And I don't know how to calculate some of that, but I'm sure some will have some numbers.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Let me call the, I think in addition, do we have both Larry Nieswander and Carol Hardy? Both? Or okay. Come on. And also Dave Fiskum. Arrayed. Who else, Dave?
Bill Johnstone from the broadcasters as well as John Powell. Just Bill and myself.
Okay, why don't you two guys go? Let's hold everything to 3 minutes from now. We've got about 25 people to testify on the next set of bills, but I think the next group are the only ones in opposition to one of these. So.
Okay.
Welcome.
Chair Greenlee, committee members, for the record, Larry Nieswander. I'm the director of the Oregon Lottery, and I will be very brief with my comments. I'm joined here at the table with Carol Hardy. She's assistant director of marketing. She's also the chair of the Problem Gambling Council for Oregon. Dual role we have her fulfill. We're just here to provide some factual information and a little history and share a couple concerns with the bill, as well as answer any questions you may have, and just confirm that we are in opposition to the proposed change in the law. And to put it in simple terms, it's really Representative Kinnemer was absolutely right. We have used video lottery television advertising very, very limited. Since 1992, when it was first authorized, it's only been used 3 times. And the reasons that it was primarily used was due to the economic recession, the smoking ban, and changes in the player demographic that our research showed they didn't understand that we had games that would allow us to compete effectively with some of the tribal casinos. We took that on to diversify our player base and also maintain a competitive place in the market to continue to provide stable revenue to state programs and services. So the Commission did use it very strategically, very selectively. We do that to maximize profits, we do that to stabilize sales, and we try to do that in balance with our mission, which is to do it in commensurate with the public good. you know, those operational challenges, and I did give you a copy of the testimony that we faced, really drove the commission to approve some spending for TV advertising, 2008, 2009, right before the smoking ban kicked in, and then earlier this year. So it's true from Representative Kendrick's testimony, we don't have any further money dedicated in this year's budget, nor in the budget that we're proposing for next year. It is a commission decision that they approve our budget annually, and at this time we have no current plans to do any more television advertising this year or next year. So the...
You're marked in opposition to the bill?
Excuse me?
You're marked in opposition to the bill.
Correct.
And you are opposing it?
Correct.
I'm not sure I understand why. You say you're not planning it, but what's the basis of it?
Well, it's a tool that we want to maintain the ability to use to fulfill the constitutional mission of the commission, which is to maximize profits commensurate with the public good. And so it's an ability that we have to educate about the games we offer. The tribal casinos who do have games that do compete with us advertise freely and frequently, and we consider it a tool that we'd like to maintain some ability as a commission to authorize it to be periodically and strategically utilized. And the law would prohibit us from doing that, as proposed. So I'm almost done.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
Just so you know, we do really try to do this in balance. We have a very mission that we want to take very, very seriously. We do consult with experts if we do any television advertising to find out whether we have anything that we try to avoid, any triggers or anything that would cause any undue enticements. And some of the folks that are in the room that will testify later on other treatment bills are ones that we rely on for that input to make sure that we are doing it in ways that take into consideration potential risks. So with that, I just wanted to let Carol Hardy, the Assistant Director for Marketing, speak very briefly about just some of the impact of advertising has had on our ability to compete.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, committee members. For the record, my name is Carol Hardy, Assistant Director for Marketing. I have held that position for 23 years, and as Director Nicewander mentioned, I am also the chair of the Oregon Council on Problem Gambling. I've served in that capacity for 4 years and have worked with the different problem gambling groups that have been in Oregon since the mid-90s. I take my responsibilities very seriously to balance the mission of making money for the state, commensurate with the public good, which one of those issues is to really manage the issue of responsible gambling. And I work very closely with many people in this room to create campaigns that also educate people about the helpline that's available. Just to reiterate, when we talk about video lottery, this really is part of our mission is to maximize revenue for the state. This is our primary product that supports state programs. We looked at research, and when we went out to advertise, we said there is an opportunity to reach beyond the people that now play our games and trying to broaden the awareness that we offer spinning reel games, which is a new product in our market. And in order to reach that broad player base, television is really the most efficient way to do that. We consulted with Alan Resnick, who's a professor of marketing at Portland State University, to ask about the effectiveness and the balance we have in our advertising programs. And the conclusions he reached is our advertising is effective. The spending to date is driving our current sales levels. The campaign-specific promotions increase sales. TV advertising drives brand awareness and opinion. And eliminating advertising creates market risks. It reduces participation of players and shrinks the player base. It makes it more narrow because you don't have the ability to educate and attract new players. Advertising is critical to the lottery's long-term success. Advertising impact appreciates within 6 months of airing. New product development requires launching. Continued messaging is required to attract new buyers. Results from other state lotteries show negative impact from advertising cutbacks. A study shows that every 1 cent you decrease in advertising results in 31 to 38 cents decline in sales. The Oregon Lottery comparative category spending is very low. Our advertising budget is relatively small. It lags the national average in lottery spending and also related to other consumer products and understanding limits sales growth. I think the other consideration that Director Nicewander mentioned is that We have been in a decline because our retailers are struggling. There's been a net drop of 32 retailers.
Please wrap it up.
Okay. And the other thing is that tribal casinos do extensively advertise and do not apply the standards that we do, and that is a direct competitor for lottery income. So in order to sustain state transfer amounts, the lottery needs to continue to have the ability to reach out to a diverse set of consumers to educate them about product offerings.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I guess a couple things, and Representative Kinmer, a little bit to you. I don't know why we didn't include all advertising for lottery, not just video, in this. I am, as the numbers start to kind of come forward, I'm a little disturbed at how much, and this is philosophical, not just directed at the lottery, at how much we spend advertising things that the state does. And those are dollars that are not directly going to the actual purpose. So I run a media company, and I've actually gotten ads come through the channel about join WIC, buy a lottery ticket, whatever. Come onto my website as buys, media buys, and they're not cheap to do. And I've heard in one department alone, we spend $17 million on advertising. Those are dollars that are not going to the bottom line. And my 9-year-old knows that we can buy lottery tickets. So without having to do the advertising piece, and I guess I'm even more concerned about the notion of that we do this to compete with tribal casinos. I mean, is that really our objective? Is that we're competitive with something that I kind of see a little more free markety in some ways? I guess it just goes to having a question of, is this the best way to generate revenue for our state? I think it's more philosophical and frustration. Do you have a figure on what your advertising budget is, all consuming, not just the video piece, but the billboards and the TV ads? Because I'm pretty sure when I checked into advertising during campaign season that a 30-second spot during Grey's Anatomy is $13,000.
Yeah.
That's expensive advertising when you're doing these primetime buys.
I think our entire fiscal year budget last year was about $8.7 million. It's down. We actually reduced it during this recession period. That's all advertising.
A lot of money.
It's less than 1% of our net sales.
Still a lot of money. Thank you.
Representative Doherty?
There was a question earlier about money spent towards gambling addiction. What is the budget for the lottery on what you spend for gambling addiction programs?
Chair and Representative Doherty, we as a lottery collect all the revenue from the sales, the net profits, and allocate that funds to DAFs, who distributes it according to the Constitution and the statute. So 1%, which is dedicated by statute, toward video lottery would be...
I don't know what the 1% is. Yeah. Actually, Wendy Halsetter, who's the problem gambling manager at DHS, would know that figure better than...
What did you just say the 1% was for advertising?
Less than 1% would be about $8.7 million.
So 1% of our sales is how we set our advertising budget. So that's an internal administrative fee. 1% of our profits goes to fund problem gambling treatment, and that's just transferred to the state. 1% is given to DHS to fund problem gambling treatment.
So if the profit's less than 10%, 1% would be probably around less than 10% of the... What did you say that number was?
No, the two aren't directly related. So I think the budget for problem gambling in FY 2011-12 was around $9 million. So that's for problem gambling treatment.
No, I don't know whether Wendy is saying that.
We'll hear about that later.
Yeah. And the other thing just to note is that we do spend about $2.5 million on problem gambling awareness and education about that there is a helpline number, that we do support the state in trying to get that message out there that treatment is available. So that is another role that the lottery fulfills.
Answer my question.
Representative Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll break for the next.
Larry, this is for you.
Sure.
You mentioned that you need to do some of the advertising and stuff to reach out to increase the market to help with the public good, because we use the money for education, parks, and things like that. I wasn't really going to weigh in on this, but when you said that, it prompted my ears to think about the public good. And I personally know people, one lady who was a teacher, her husband went out and remortgaged their house and everything else. They lost their home, everything they had, inheritance, because he was gambling, and it was all video lottery. Mm. When he was supposed to be at work, he was playing a poker machine every day. These are issues that are happening. I would say we're doing public damage more than we are public good when we have situations like this, because people are mortgaging their hilt to pay their homes and everything else to do this. And how do we address those issues? Because I'm seeing we need to be using this 1% more effectively, not advertising and working with the people who have the machines, saying, hey, someone can't be on this machine more than an hour a day, or come up with some sort of standards or something like that if they want to use them. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, and if the lottery has even thought about doing anything like that, because the casinos have player cards. They track everything that a person does at a casino, and you got to drive 40 miles to get there. We have lottery machines two blocks from your home. People know they're there.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask Kenner also for the last question after you answer this.
Okay.
And maybe you'll stick around because we're going to combine all three of the bills.
I will.
To get them done expeditiously.
I will.
You may want to comment before we're done again.
Yes. Chair Greenlick and Representative Weider, thank you for that question. We have thought about that. We don't control the 1% and whether it stays in DHS for problem gambling treatment or not. That's really a legislative call. But we agree that amount of money is appropriate and necessary for the program. We have thought about the issue of how do we further implement responsible gambling features in our game system. And you're correct. The tribes are a little bit ahead of us in terms of technology and their use of a player card. We have that on our roadmap and something we would very much interested in doing. It would move us away from anonymous play. It would allow us to set limits. It would allow us to shut off terminals or end gambling sessions. We just aren't quite there yet, but it is on our roadmap. It's something we're very interested in doing. It's in balance with technology as well as accountability, and it's something we're very much interested in looking at toward the future for those reasons.
Kenner, last question.
Yeah, thank you. What year was video lottery added?
1992.
So one of those three times that you've done advertising didn't include video. Or two times? You said there were three instances from 1982. So
92, actually. And they were actually 2008... 2009,
for a
smoking
11.
Ban. Yeah, 9, 10, and 11, I guess.
Okay, thank you. My comment was that right in the heart of the recession. Thank you. When people are most vulnerable.
I have a very brief question. I understand the new lottery game that you were talking about is the one that's designed particularly to help addicted people get more addicted. Is that, am I characterizing that correctly, or the wheel game that you were?
You know, I guess I'll defer that to marketing director, but my understanding, it's just a competitive game that's present in other competitive gaming markets, whether it's the tribal casinos or other casinos. It's just a state-of-the-art game that the machine providers and the software providers provide for entertainment.
Thank you very much for testifying. I'm going to open up. We do need to move on both these. I'm going to open up a public hearing. In addition to the public hearing on 2899, I'm going to open up a public hearing on 3343 and a public hearing on 3344. I'll ask Representative Tomei and I hope Representative Kotek to testify briefly on this, and then I'll bring up the three people opposed to House Bill 2899, and then ask all the people that are in favor of these other ones to try and coordinate their time so we can speed this up and get them all three done in the 45 minutes we hope for.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and Committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify here today. For the record, I'm Carolyn Tomei. I represent House District 41, which is Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. Thank you for your interest in this issue. It's an issue I've been very concerned about and worked on for many years. And thank you especially, Representative Weider, for your question. It's an excellent question. I hope you continue your interest and keep asking those questions. Gambling addiction is a problem that has substantial repercussions in nearly all spheres of individual's life. Professionally and personally, gambling can ruin an individual and her family. The gambler often loses her job. The family may not be able to retain a home, feed her children, or pay utilities when a gambler cannot get treatment for her addiction. This can lead to a series of events that cause a disruption to family and can cause the family to be a burden to the state rather than a contributing asset. One factor that needs to be stressed is that problem gambling is an addiction and needs behavioral health treatment just like other addictions and other mental illnesses. Nearly half of all problem gamblers have considered suicide. It's estimated that 75% of problem gamblers have experienced a trauma in their lives that contributed to the dissociation and coping mechanism that leads to gambling addiction. 20% of these people come from a home with a history of mental illness, including substance abuse and pathological gambling. Clearly, the background of environmental and biological influences on an individual indicates that a gambling problem is actually a gambling addiction. An addiction needs treatment, and that is what House Bill 3343 and 3344 will ensure. I think included in your packet is written testimony from Eva Bone. Rita, like most addicts trying to recover, relapsed three times before she succeeded at Bridgeway Recovery Services. We had in a previous committee hearing people talking about who were addicted to gambling and also been addicted to other drugs previously. They said it's much more difficult to get rid of a gambling addiction than it is addiction to alcohol or other illegal drugs. She notes that none of the money used to fund gambling treatment comes out of the general fund. Rather, it is completely funded by the Oregon Lottery. House Bill 3343 will ensure that policy around gambling treatment is formed by experts with experience and dedication to the issues of problem gambling. 3344 will ensure that 1% of the lottery dollars dedicated to problem gambling treatment is maintained as a floor for funding levels, not as the top, not as the ceiling, but as the floor. Even when overall lottery revenue dips, we have to protect these services, and this is a good way to do it. And I thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs, and I urge you to move these measures forward.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. It's a real pleasure to be here today with Representative Chmay and having Representative Kettemer on the committee, two champions who have continued to focus on the issues of problem gambling, and so I'm glad to be here today with them. I sponsored both of these bills, 3343 and 3344, on behalf of the Oregon Voices of Problem Gambling Recovery, a relatively new organization created to educate people about the dynamics of problem gambling, promote recovery and provide support for those dealing with this addiction, and advocate to state and local government on behalf of problem gamblers and their families. Several members of that group came and testified a few weeks back in the Human Services Subcommittee evening public testimony in the Addictions and Mental Health Budget, and very compelling testimony. It's been a real honor to meet some of these individuals in recovery because it is a very difficult journey, and I think you'll be hearing from them today. Problem gambling is a real and serious addiction that drives dangerous behavior. 74,000 Oregonians meet the definition of pathological or problem gamblers, but only 1,800 of them get help through state programs, and that was last year's number. Recent national estimates place the social economic cost of problem gamblers at approximately $3,000 each and $11,000 for each pathological gambler, or an estimated social economic cost in excess of $449 million for Oregonians. We have a very significant role in problem gambling in the state. We, meaning the legislature, and those of us that depend on lottery dollars here at the state. Lottery retailers are the location of 76% of gambling activity from problem gamblers, while Indian casino gambling is only about 14%. In terms of games played, 64% of problem gamblers prefer video poker, while 13% play slot games. One of the reasons that we hear over and over again from individuals in recovery is the difficulty of getting clean from this addiction because there is a video poker practically on every corner. It's not hard to find. You can play Keno in your local mini-mart. It's everywhere. It is ubiquitous, and we are responsible for that. These bills try to get at this issue in two different ways. House Bill 3343 would require the health authority to really put a dedicated advisory group of experts to deal with how we spend the problem gambling dollars for treatment and prevention here in the state. It's not too much to ask to really focus, have individuals who know something about this leading the policy discussions around that. House Bill 3344, as Representative Toomey described, would say that our obligation, 1% of lottery dollars, needs to continually be provided for prevention and treatment. That number fluctuates. Has lottery dollars fluctuate? This bill would say that there's a floor, and if the lottery dollars drop next year, we'd still be spending that amount of dollars. It's not a huge amount, but it will provide consistency and stability for the treatment providers and the prevention efforts in the state. And we really do have a moral obligation. When we say 1%, we mean 1%, and that's what this bill is about. So I hope you'll be able to support both of these bills, send them on their merry way to perhaps Ways and Means. We'd love to see them. And I know you'll look forward to the testimony that's coming. So thank you very much.
Representative Thompson and I have just had a little time to talk about this. We think what we may do, and we'll be talking to you about it along the way, is to consolidate these and take a serious activity in the interim to try and perfect something that we can all agree to bring back in February, because I think we all agree on the seriousness of this problem. We'll take some more testimony, but I think we... Yes, sir.
I agree. One of the things that, I don't know, is sort of frustrating about this whole proposition is, you know, it's really easy to bring the lottery people in here and beat on them for a while.
Please do. It's always fun.
But let's remember that we are the ones who set up this system. We, along with the people of Oregon, and we have consistently instructed them to go forth and raise as much money as they can that we are spending every dime of in the process, you know, and it kind of, you know, it's hard to identify the problem gambler from the problem gamblee or whatever, in that, you know, we actually engineered this problem to support programs in the state of Oregon, and it's very hard to break our addiction to that income. And I guess as an aside, I might throw in, we're doing the same thing right now with medical marijuana on trying to figure out ways to tax that, because we can use the revenue to support all these wonderful things in Oregon.
One bill at a time, Mr.
And I just, you know,
let's deal with one social
when we're talking
time
about
today.
Legalized vice, let's be a little careful where we tread.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I may make a quick comment, I would encourage you, if we end up going into the interim and you do more work on this, I think it's really something to dig into, is to have the Lottery Commission come in. They have a new director, or at least a new interim director, who's had a chance to meet. You know, we've suggested, I think...
Let's hear briefly.
Yes, well, we suggested a couple years ago that, you know, they talk about, well, we advertise the 800 number. Well, how about it have it flash every 5 seconds on your lottery screen when you're playing video poker? I think people would see it then, so...
Yeah.
I have a plan to wean the state off its addiction as well. Mr. White, the last word.
And mine will stay germane to the issue. carrying this over to the interim, I think, is a good idea. I think one of the things, those player cards that I was talking about, is something we probably should look at taking lottery dollars if we're going to continue with video lottery, to where they have to plug them in, and then we know what each person's doing. It might cut back some of the play, but there's going to be people that will know if they're getting too serious on the poker machine. But those are innovative strategies that I think we really need to look at and talk with the commission seriously about implementing if we're going to keep doing lottery. Otherwise, we need to do away with lottery.
Yep. Thank you both very much. All right, last one. Brief.
So I guess, you know, and not that I haven't gone and gambled, you're talking to someone who got married in Las Vegas, so.
Good luck.
But I guess my concern is, and I look at things like when we have such a heavy reliance on one source of revenue, and it goes up and down, right? Now we're in this problem with the lottery, some of it because we're in a recession and people aren't gambling as much, and now we don't have the money. and yet we continue as a body, and I've watched it as a as just the Monday morning quarterback when the ballot measures come out, where we chase single source revenue to buy toothbrushes for kids, right? So we want to use lottery dollars and use it for economic development, parks, and education. We want to do a cigarette tax so we can do this. We want to do a soda tax so we can do that, instead of having an honest conversation about
Germane to the topic.
So how, if we were to go away from some of this, what's the replacement? I mean, how do you then, how do you really truly get people off of this as a habit when you're talking about single source money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, I think those are good questions. I think what's interesting about a lot of this is, I think it's that compact. When voters said, we want lottery in the state, one of the selling points was the 1%. So I think those are all good questions. I think when we talk about new revenue sources, this one always seems unique to me, because we said as a state, agree to have lottery in the state as a game and an additional resource, but we're going to do the 1%. And what we've been doing over the last couple biennia is we'll have that 1% number, and then maybe we'll only spend 85% of it or 90% of it, and it's not actually, in the grand scheme of the budget, that much, but I think it's that we made a promise that we do the 1%. So, and I can get you some numbers, because it's not like, $20, $50 million, but it would be that consistency to say, we are at least going to get that amount because we've made that promise. And so it's unfortunate that it's been played with, because I think voters assumed that it meant that 1% would go every year to this. So, but thank you for the question.
Thank you very much for presenting this. Mr. Fiskum, you can bring your team against the civilization as we know it. It's not coming to an end as a result of this bill, so if you would keep your opposition to 2 minutes each, that would be helpful. And is Mr. Martin a part of this?
No. We're just together, Mr. Chair. The record, Dave Fiskum here, representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. I did want to be here today to appear before you, because normally I would be appearing here wearing my healthcare hat. This time I'm wearing my broadcaster hat. And to the extent that you go beyond today's hearing to have questions, I wanted to make sure you knew I was available to help answer them. Otherwise, my purpose today is primarily to introduce to you Bill Johnstone, the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. I would say one other quick thing. If we were here to testify on whether the lottery should exist in Oregon or not, our testimony would be very different than what we will be testifying to you about for the 2 minutes we have, Mr. Chair. I know. 4 minutes we have, Mr. Chair. We will be testifying directly and specifically and only on the narrow provisions of House Bill 2899. That said, I will defer to Mr. Johnstone with your permission, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Co-chairs, committee, and for the record, I'm Bill Johnstone. I'm the president and CEO of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. And as Mr. Fiskum indicated, my comments would have been greatly different. Prior to hearing the testimony that we just heard, I am here to testify in total opposition to House Bill 2899. However, hearing some of the things that I've heard opened up a plethora of conversations I would enjoy having in the coffee shop or in another venue someplace.
Or in the interim.
Or in the interim, yes, very, very definitely. So I would just simply say that the broadcasters are very much opposed to House Bill 2899 for a number of reasons, one of being the money that it will take out of the state of Oregon if this bill were to pass and this restriction were to fly. So, again, we're strongly opposed to it, and we'll give our time to ladies and gentlemen from another committee.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mr. Fiskum, were you here when in 92 when the video was added, video lottery?
Mr. Chair, co-chairs, committee members, Representative Kennemer, I'm going to give you a little bit of a longer answer than your question. I was actually here in the governor's office when the lottery started, and I remember the debate we had in the governor's office, then Governor Tia. And I know we had a vigorous debate. I was at the Economic Development Department when we got the first dollop of lottery dollars when it started, and we invested those dollars in economic development programs, and that continues today. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Kennemer, the short answer is I was here in 1992 as well, though I was in my private sector guise at that point.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up, please. Do you recall how the agreement was reached that the lottery would not do
TV promotion of video lottery?
Mr. Chair, I don't. Will you join us while we're... Please go ahead. I'm sorry. If you're here to testify, come in and join us.
Do you remember?
No.
Mr. Chair, we don't remember...
Actually, I was on television at that time.
We don't remember the specifics of the 1992 negotiations. The previous lottery director might, or Mr. Nyswander may have a...
Yeah, well, I think there's a problem with institutional memory, which is part of the reason that these bills come forward, is when the rules aren't followed and commitments aren't kept over time, it gets to be a problem. That's the reason I introduced the bill. Thank you.
My only quick comment in that is that I think the Oregon Association of Broadcasters has kept all of its commitments on every front relative to the placement of advertising and our willingness to consider such advertising.
I can't see why they wouldn't want to try to get any contract they could.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
My issue is not with you, actually, but it is with commitments that are made by public agencies to the legislature.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
President Doherty?
Yeah, I'll make this very quick. And maybe you can't answer this question, but would television advertising, if you're really an addicted gambler, would that make a difference whether you'd become an addicted gambler or not?
I can't.
That's the issue at hand.
Yeah.
I think there's a difference.
Co-chairs committee.
I
can't answer that question. Fortunately, I'm not an addicted gambler.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very
much. Thank you very much,
Mr. Chair. Eric Martin, not here. Close the...
He's here.
People
are still smoking. So.
They're trying to get you up there. You were resistant.
We shouldn't spend the money.
2 minutes, please, Mr. Martin.
I think I may have written down the wrong thing
the
on
wrong
my
bill?
Sheet
okay.
there.
Well, they're all open, so...
Okay, so this is in regards to advertising on television. My name is Eric Martin, Representative Greenlick, and committee members. I'm the policy and legislative liaison with the Addiction Counselor Certification Board of Oregon, and I'm passing out some written testimony as well. In the Journal of Gaming Studies, research studies concluded that the onset of problem gambling occurred 3 times more rapidly with video machine gamblers than with traditional gamblers. This is a journal co-funded by gaming corporations and the National Council on Problem Gambling. So both the purveyors of gambling and researchers in the field of gambling addiction agree that, yes, video poker appears to be more addictive and have a higher addictive liability than other forms of gaming, and that's oftentimes why they refer to it as video crack. It's a serious problem here in Oregon because half of all profits from Oregon video games come from about 10% of its players. Most people seeking help for gambling addiction say lottery retailers are the primary place that they play. You've heard most of these statistics previously from the previous folks that were up here. But what you may not have heard is in relation to the aforementioned crimes that were mentioned by Representative Parrish, more than one-third of problem gamblers say they have committed an illegal act to get gambling money, and nearly half of problem gamblers say they have considered suicide. So when we look at broadening the net to get more people to gamble through television advertising, it will inherently bring more problem gamblers to the surface. And increasing the volume of people playing video crack or the most addictive form of gambling will increase crime. There have been cost-benefit studies. Dr. Murata could probably tell you
Please
more about
up.
Those. And I just want to say there's an old saying in Nevada that says Las Vegas wasn't built on winners. And I don't think that's the reputation that we want for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, we're way behind, so we're going to try and move quickly through. I ask you, we have both 3343 and 3344 open. Please take 2 minutes, and if somebody's already said it, don't say it again. So we'll go for about 20 minutes more on this, and then I'll move back and forth between the two panels. So let's start with Tom Moore and Sharon Williams and Jeff, I think, Masiota. Go for it.
I will. Thank you very much, Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Thompson, and committee members. Thank you very much for this opportunity. For the record, my name, I'm talking really fast to get done quickly. My name is Tom Moore. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Council on Problem Gambling in Wilsonville, Oregon. First off, the council is extremely delighted that we're having this conversation today about the support of the problem gambling programs, both the committee and the funding. Just a clarification, Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson, one of the problems with the funding is that the money goes into a fund, and then it goes from the fund into DHS. That fund has been swept clean almost every biennium. So that's been the problem, that as the money gets cut, there's nothing there to back it up. So again, on behalf of the council, I'm very pleased, we're all very pleased that we're having this conversation, and we very strongly support both of the House bills, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, I am Dr. Jeff Murata. I'm president of the consulting firm Problem Gambling Solutions. From 2000 to 2007, I was the Problem Gambling Services Manager working within the Department of Human Services. I'm here to provide you some background information on 3343 and also 3344, and I'll provide this separately. Regarding 3343, which is the bill that calls for an advisory committee to the Oregon Health Authority. When I was a problem gambling services manager assigned to administer the problem gambling treatment and prevention services, I was hired as the agency's first manager in that position, and I was instructed to develop and implement a plan for the administration of statewide problem gambling services. One of my first actions was to create an advisory committee to make policy and program recommendations. Throughout my tenure as a problem gambling services manager, my unit staff advisory groups that I would routinely call upon to provide important stakeholder input. After my departure from DHS, new policies and business processes were implemented, and the use of a formal problem gambling services advisory committee was discontinued. The consequences of this action were not fully apparent until this current biennium, when program revenues decreased. As you heard, the way that the program is funded is indexed to 1% of lottery proceeds. And what had happened this past biennium, really for the first time, is the proceeds dipped rather significantly. At the time, the budget authorization was given to DHS for problem gambling services. The number was $4.9 million. However, there had to be a correction made because of the decreased revenues. Unfortunately, most of the program reductions that were taken this past biennium occurred in the second year of the biennium, resulting in a 41% decrease in budget between the first year and the second year. As you can imagine, the extent of the reductions required services to be significantly reduced or eliminated. During the decision process of how to respond to the reduced budget, there was no formal advisory group to call upon, and I sat at that time on the board of the Oregon Council on Problem Gambling and the board of the Voices of Problem Gambling Recovery, and I do not recall these groups being solicited for recommendations regarding actions to address this crisis. In the end, difficult decisions were made without the structured process to seek consumer input, expert input, or other stakeholder input aside from conversations with county administrators and a select few others. I believe the extensive infrastructure losses to the problem gambling services system could have been reduced if program and policy changes were apparent with more regard to the public program in terms of vetting proposals for change with providers, consumers, and other stakeholder groups. Well-run, well-informed, and fully funded problem gambling services is essential in promoting Oregon's public health, and I believe with all the tools in place that the publicly funded system to reduce gambling-related harm is a good investment, a collaborative and shared concern, and a public service that saves lives, preserves families, and strengthens communities. So I urge you to stand behind the principles of community involvement, consumer advocacy, and stakeholder involvement through your support of HB 3343.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Can I have Wes Wood?
I think.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, one more.
Oh, I'm sorry. You were hiding among those.
I'm the quiet type.
Yeah. A lonely little petunia in a onion patch.
All right.
And now.
My name is Sharon Williams, and I'm a board member of Voices of Problem Gambling Recovery. I'm an unemployed gambling counselor and a person in long-time recovery. I'm here to support House Bill 3343. I'm not going to repeat the budget cuts that were made during the last biennium, so I'm just going to go straight to the point of I believe it is critical that we stand behind the principles of community involvement, consumer advocacy, and stakeholder involvement, and I ask you to please support House Bill 3343. That's it. But I also have 3344.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm still Sharon Williams. And you already know about the budget cuts. So I'm just going to say that protecting these funds is critical. These funds save lives, preserve families, and strengthen our community. And I do urge you to support House Bill 3344. And I want to show you this. I actually had this at home and forgot it, so I drew it here. But this is, and I'll give this to you guys if you really want it. But this is a heart, and this was used as an affirmation in a residential treatment program when I was working there. And it said, in the center, it says, I want to live. This statement was written by a residential gambling client after her entrance into Ridgeway Recovery Residential Gambling Treatment Program. Prior to her entrance, she had experienced many lows to her addiction, including a failed suicide attempt. Actually, she had had more than one failed suicide attempt. After entering treatment, she remained severely depressed and repeatedly voiced she had no will to live. One morning, someone burned the toast, which caused the smoke alarms to go off. She was in the shower. She got out, put on a robe, and rushed out of the building shouting, I want to live. And when she that was shared during our morning group, and then she made this to put on the wall as an affirmation. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Mr. Chair, if I may, yes. A question.
Please.
I don't think we've had the issue of treatment actually addressed directly. What typically does it cost? How long does it typically take? And what's your effectiveness rate? Or in a minute or less? I'm sorry, but
that's right. 1 minute. But,
thank you.
Yeah, but at least we ought to talk about this.
You mean to the clients or to the state?
Clients, yeah. What's the cost to get into treatment, and how long does it typically take, and how effective is it generally? And I could have been.
Treatment in Oregon is free.
Yeah.
We refer to it as prepaid treatment.
Okay.
So they don't have any cost, except maybe if they come to residential treatment, they may leave work or other things, but sometimes those things are already happening. As far as how effective it is, you know, that's always depending on the person. I believe that is very effective, but not everybody gets it. In the first time or even the first 3 times, and some even the first 10 times. But you can always tell the difference from when somebody arrives to when they leave. And that's in both outpatient treatment and in residential treatment. I personally believe that it's very, very effective. And I know many people in long-term recovery that have done treatment, and it has helped them greatly.
Excuse me, and one more question. How long have you been in recovery?
Over 20 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Can I now, can I have Westwood, David Ellsburn, and Karen Wheeler? Jonathan, you want a minute as well? Where is he?
Good afternoon. My name is Westwood, and I am the one that you're looking to identify. I'm the problem gambler. I'm 6 years in recovery. I'm currently president of the Voices of Problem Gambling Recovery. I'm here to help you see what it looks like. It's your neighbor. It's your board member friends. It's your grocer. It's all of those things. I come to you from 60 years as an Oregon resident, born in Dallas, pruned capital of the world. But I wanted to speak to you today simply to help you put a face to what it is to be a gambler in Oregon, video poker. You know, my process is pretty typical. Trauma, clinical depression, prescription drugs that spiked me into the video poker, And that spiral went on for probably 10 years before I got treatment through a program. And so we are here to provide answers to those questions for that element that you otherwise have to speculate what that means, what it feels like, what it looks like, what those triggers are, what the advertising does, and how that all plays out. So if it goes to interim, we are more than happy to participate in that element with you. So
we'll make lots of time. Can I ask you a brief question? Did you end up in the criminal justice system as well?
No, I did not.
Fortune.
Thank you. A question about prescription drug spiked. Could you explain that?
Zoloft was my prescribed medicine.
For antidepressant.
And that's all that was. Yeah. But it was just, you know, I just happened to be that one element that it took a marginal, difficult, compulsive behavior and took it to a whole new level, and video poker was there for me.
Thank you for being here. I appreciate
it.
I know it is absolutely sometimes challenging to get
up. You know, we've been doing this for a little while now, and some of us went to Arizona and spoke to their clinicians about a month ago, and we've done work in Washington as well. We spoke to the national convention last year, and it always amazes me the types of questions that we get, because it all seems so obvious to me what it is.
So I have one for you.
Okay.
How much did you spend?
In losses?
Mm-hmm.
Properties, real estate.
I'm sure at some point you've added it up. Do you have a
you can't add it.
Sense of
and what I know, what I know most in recovery is it doesn't matter. It was everything I happened to have.
It might matter to folks in here to actually hear how much, you know, a dollar amount that comes out of
the pocket. Well, when I first went into treatment, I was comfortable saying it's probably hundreds of thousands.
Thank you.
But after a couple years in treatment, it grew. So it can be enormous, which I'm glad to say I've paid it all back. But
thank you very much.
Yeah.
And we will have a chance to spend some time with you.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes.
My name is David Ellsburn, and I want to speak about 3343 and 3344. Jeff Morado mentioned that the budget cuts last year for the lottery for the gambling treatment programs were like 40%, and this is pretty difficult. Lost some good counselors, you know, some of which will never come back to the field, some who moved away from Oregon and will never come back. The clients had to decide. Some of them were eventually cut from the program, and some of them quit the program because they would have had to travel further, or because their favorite counselor was lost their job. And it was also mentioned earlier about the suicide rate for gamblers is high, and so whenever these things happen, it's very, very unsettling for the clients and destructive. Lost most of the beds of the residential program, which is really important for the most critically ill pathological gamblers. Now that I have some budget figures here, which I won't quote, except to say that alcohol and drug addiction dollar, for every $20 spent on those programs, there's about $1 spent on gambling addiction. So this is really kind of out of whack. And I would never say to rearrange the pie and spend more money on gambling at the loss of the other programs, because I don't want to drive down a dark road in the middle of the night and run into somebody who's been drinking because their program has been cut. But we do need to stabilize the gambling treatment funds. So I think the 3344 is really important. As far as the advisory committee...
Please wrap it up.
Okay. I just wanted to say something about the $28.99, that when you show ads on TV that are showing people in action on machines, this is, for a gambler, one thing you have to do when they're in recovery is to try to reduce all the gambling triggers. And this is a big trigger for a gambler. So whenever an ad shows up on the TV, I have to run over real quick and turn off the TV so the gambler in my house is not triggered. And so gambling, advertising on TV is really a bad idea as far as the social costs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Karen?
Cortez Greenlick and Thompson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addiction Programs Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to provide information about both bills, and I'll just summarize my comments briefly on both bills. House Bill 3343 is where I'll begin. This bill requiring the Oregon Health Authority to establish an advisory committee. I would like to say just right off the bat that I would be, and my staff would also be very happy to work in the interim with anybody on this committee or anybody else on these issues. There would be a small fiscal impact as a result of this bill, as it would require us to do some things that we don't currently do exactly. However, I will say that we do have advisory committees in place. We have two specific advisory committees for the Hispanic population as well as the Asian American population that we've started just in the last 3 years. We also have continued in a little bit of a different way the advisory committee that was began under Dr. Murata. We meet quarterly with that group of providers, and we do it virtually through a program called GoToMeeting so that people don't have to drive from various parts of the state to Salem to save money. I would also like to add that the Addictions and Mental Health Division did specifically engage providers on the issue of funding allocations and resources last biennium, and every provider had the opportunity to provide input when we had to make those reductions. I think that's where I'll end, except to say that I'm excited to see voices of problem gambling recovery. We do provide them with a little bit of financial support, and I believe we really need to listen to people who have that background, who come from the recovery community, and try to find more important ways to engage them in policy development.
Karen, thank you very much.
So on moving on to House Bill 30.
Don't move on. Oh, you're done. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll see you in the interim. Yes. Thank you very much. Jonathan, you get 1 minute. Wrap it up. We'll hear about opera again, I'm sure.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames. I'm actually here on behalf of Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare, one of the state's largest gambling treatment providers here in the state. And I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3344, which sets the 1% floor for gambling. And I just want to say that the last time there was a significant revenue drop in gambling treatment, the number of programs were shuttered, a number of people and clients were not served, our penetration level into the community to serve those folks has dropped. And so what the 1% floor really does is it makes good on the state's kind of moral responsibility that if they're going to provide these games and create this problem, that there has to be someone there to be able to help fix it when there are problems arise. So stability in the program is very important. House Bill 3344 does that, and we really would like to see that passed. But thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right.
I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 3343, 3344, 2899. As we said before, we'll put this on our agenda, on our work plan. In fact, we may be able to spend some time on it at the end of this session while we're still in business. And I think it's something we all recognize is a very important problem. I'm going to carry over the public hearing and possible work session of 2224. And we'll put that back on the agenda for when next we meet, if we can get it. And we're going to open up a public hearing on, where is it? On 2386. We're going to spend about 20 minutes on this one. Can I give Mr. Bergstein here, organizing... Dave, are you, is Len here?
He was here.
If you come in and organize 10 minutes on the pro side of this, and we'll get a few minutes on the negative side, organize it however you want it. We'll give you the whole 10 minutes. You want to get him in here? Whatever. We don't need him. Dave, go for it.
Okay, how much time?
10 minutes.
Okay. Co-chair Greenlick and Thompson, members of the committee, I'm Dave Sanders. I'm an Oregon physician and a co-founder of ZoomCure. We're testifying today in favor of House Bill 2386. This is not just an isolated, standalone bill. This is part of a continuum of delivery system reform. As you recall, in last session, this committee led the passage of a bill that transformed the way in which PAs are regulated in this state, and that led directly to three very important outcomes. First, it led directly to the expansion of the provider workforce in this state. We were able to grow from a handful of providers to over 30 full-time primary providers practicing in Oregon. Two, it directly led to decreasing costs. That bill created a framework for flexibility and innovation that allowed us to decrease waste and to allow us to raise to decrease our cost, $99 for every single visit, regardless of complexity or severity of the patient situation. And third, this bill that passed last year allowed us to increase the quality of care. We're able to use the efficiencies to invest in a novel new way to organize ourselves around hiring, training, and performance system that now actually is being utilized and seen as a model around the country. We know that states are looking at the Oregon model as their model now for PA oversight. So that's the context for seeing this bill today, 2386, which is a key step in reforming our primary care workforce framework. It's modest but a meaningful reform that enables PAs and NPs to provide their patients with prepackaged medications they have prescribed, as doctors have long done successfully and safely in this state. So with this bill, remember that both PAs and NPs, importantly, currently have the authority to diagnose, treat, and prescribe, and are proven effective at doing so. The research documenting the efficacy of PAs and NPs is overwhelming, and you know that. But again, both have full authority to diagnose, treat, and prescribe, and even administer treatments, yet neither can dispense their medications or treatments to their customers. Does this make sense that they can prescribe prescribe amoxicillin, but they can't give it to their customer in the office? Of course not. So I want to be very brief and very focused here. I have, over the last year, a chance to meet with the broad stakeholders in our community across the delivery system on this issue, and has wide support from all the institutions, physicians, PAs, NPs, consumers. There is, at this point, only a single opponent to this, and that opponent is the large mega chain drugstores. And you will hear them raise two issues with this. The first is they will claim patient safety issue, and two, they will claim that this might be injurious to the economic viability of locally owned pharmacies. So I want to really focus on those two points: safety, and then the competitive threat to local pharmacies. First, safety. Under HB 2386, in order for a PA to dispense, their supervisor would have to file with the Oregon Medical Board. And the filing is significant. It would require a drug formulary, a drug control program, a detailed description of how you would go about managing those medications, inventory, tracking, recalls, the entire system, and third, it would require an audited annual report. So that's the first point about safety. The second one is that it also requires PAs and NPs to go through a dispensing training program developed by their own boards and the pharmacy board. That's point two. Point three is that this bill strictly prohibits the dispensing of narcotics by PAs. Fourth, PAs and NPs have long been able to dispense in California and Washington, and according to our research, effectively and safely in those states. And importantly, this regimen here is far more restrictive, far stricter than the regimens in those states. In fact, this is the most restrictive dispensing regimen in the country. It's a very conservative approach to going about this. The final point about safety is this. federal law, the Affordable Care Act, now requires electronic record systems to contain drug cross-reaction databases and to enable e-prescribing, which allows you to tap into the pharmacist databases to ensure that you have all the information at your fingertips to ensure you have the safest possible data for prescribing and dispensing. It's belts and suspenders now. So that's the case for safety.
Halfway there.
Right. That's the case for safety. That's 5 minutes? Okay. So the last point is, on the competitive threat, it's absolutely, as you know, it's not true. The core threat today to local pharmacists has been the large drugstore chains. They are a vanishing breed, unfortunately. It has nothing to do with this bill. It has only to do with the consolidation of the economics in the industry. We are the best partners of the local chains, the local pharmacists, and there are very few left. With that, my colleagues here at the Barge, the PA, and then Dr. Katz, our medical director.
Good.
Co-Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Thompson, and members of the committee. As Dr. Zander said, my name is Sarah Thabarge. I'm a physician assistant, and it's my pleasure to meet with you to discuss how the passage of this bill would affect my colleagues and I. I know that we all here today share the same goal, to ensure a safe and medically sound patient experience, while at the same time minimizing unnecessary costs and barriers that might keep patients from receiving the maximum benefit of our healthcare system. I've spent the majority of my life either training to become or working as a physician assistant. Before I came to ZoomCare, I worked in an urban emergency department, and I witnessed firsthand the impact that our country's dysfunctional healthcare system can have on patients. I started thinking that there must be a better way to care for patients in an appropriate setting at affordable rates, and that's when I found ZoomCare. It was like they had read my mind. The barriers of insurance red tape, difficult scheduling, and expensive charges have been removed. The bill before you is one more step in removing these barriers that exist for patients and for clinicians. As you know, PAs are master's-level clinicians who work with physicians to perform physicals, diagnose and treat illnesses, order and interpret labs, and prescribe medications. According to a RAND Corporation study, we perform at least 80% of the functions performed by most physicians, and we save the healthcare system approximately 20% in cost. Our malpractice premiums are historically low, which many attribute to the excellent care that we're trained to provide. As you consider this bill, I believe it's relevant to note a few points. First, in order to be certified by the NCCPA, we need at least 75 hours of pharmacology courses. We have full prescribing rights in all 50 states. We're able to inject patients in the exam room with medications like Phenergan, Toradol, epinephrine, Depo-Provera, but we can actually put the prescription bottle into a patient's hand. The steps that we go through to take care of each patient are safe. Dr. Katz is going to reference the safety checks that we do every time we see a patient, every time we would prescribe a medication. In closing, I'd just like to say that the goals of keeping patients safe and providing access to medical evaluation and treatment are not mutually exclusive. At ZoomCare, we believe that with the appropriate guidelines, a well-trained staff, and some forward-thinking, these will go hand in hand. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, rural.
Is that? Sorry. Hi. There's some paper I'd like to have you see as well.
Coming.
Co-Chairs Greenlick and Thompson and members of the committee. My name is Jeffrey Katz. I'm a board-certified family physician and the medical director of ZoomCare. From the start, ZoomCare holds at its core a deep commitment to provide excellent quality care. And over the last 5 years, we've been developing and perfecting a system that brings the best care to the neighborhoods that we serve. There are many safety systems that are currently in place at ZoomCare, but I'd like to focus on the process for dispensing medicines at ZoomCare. The exact process that I've been following as a physician dispensing medicines over the last 5 years. I'd like you to see this is a simple but safe process, and I know that this can be performed safely by my excellent team of physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and other MDs. There are three things that a provider has in front of her at ZoomCare, even before dispensing. Those three things are a chart in front of her, first. Past medical history, family history, the detailed allergy list, which contains the specific type of reaction the patient had.
You're out of time, but we'll give you one more minute.
Thanks. And a complete medicine list. She has state-of-the-art tools available to her, the same tools that the pharmacists use, the same databases. And she has a patient in front of her. The rapport she's built with that patient over multiple visits. The three things she does before dispensing. She checks for interactions, she checks for contraindications, and she checks against the patient's allergies, just like the pharmacists do. She's using all the tools that are available to a modern workforce and that are built into our technology. And there are three things she does during the dispensing. She personally identifies a prepackaged bottle on the shelf to make sure the patient's getting the correct medicine. She's checking it in the computer with a laser barcode scanner that eliminates the possibility that this could be a recalled or an expired medicine. And she's personally discussing the precautions, the instructions, and the side effects with the patient and is handing out the instructions required by law that you have in front of you now. She also has resources available to her, including a supervising physician in our clinical command center who's available for questions every single minute, every single day that we see patients. Now, some will propose that there's a system of checks and balances at the pharmacy level. And I propose that with every increase in human contact with a task, with a single task, there's a proportionate increase for the number of errors. Compare what happens now in the real world every day with the family practice down the street to what's happening in Zoom care with a streamlined approach.
Please wrap it up.
Okay. As you know, at the family practice, a doctor writes a prescription with his chicken scratch. The medical assistant then tries to interpret this, not knowing the medicine names or the pharmacy shorthand, calls it in via voicemail. Then a pharmacist interprets the voicemail, not having a live person they're speaking to, and then writes it down, hands it to the med tech, who then puts it in the computer, and the pharmacist then hands it to the patient. In Zoom care, the person that's dispensing the medicine is the same person that's choosing which medicine to use.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes, please. So your doctors can do this now, but your PAs can't. Is that how I
understand? True, absolutely correct.
Okay, that's all I want to know. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes. I just have a quick question. So you said that you checked with a number of different interest groups, providers, and the only people in opposition were certain pharmacies. Was that just interest groups in the metro area or throughout the state?
We talked with all of the associations that were statewide. You know,
we're going to have two in opposition. We'll be able to hear. Okay. Let's give one more minute to Lorleen Dunsmer and Jennifer Pratt, who are also in favor. If you could do it in 1 minute, that would be great. Thank you very much, guys. That's very, very brief. And then we'll have Liz Hoochin and Jackson Leong in opposition. Give you 3 minutes each so you can begin thinking about it. Yes, go for it.
Co-Chairs Greenlick and Thompson and members of the committee, my name is Lorleen Dunsmere and I'm a family nurse practitioner practicing at one of the Providence Immediate Care Clinics. I'm here today representing the Oregon Nurse Association and the Nurse Practitioners of Oregon and presenting testimony in favor of House Bill 2386 with the -1 amendment, which would remove dispensing restrictions for NPs and create a dispensing formulary for physician assistants. As you know, nurse practitioners in Oregon enjoy very liberal practice laws with opportunity for independent practice and full prescribing authority, including controlled substances. There are approximately 2,500 NPs in Oregon, and of those, currently about 225 are already dispensing, most of those in rural settings. I've been in an immediate care setting for about 6 years now and seeing patients with broad medical conditions prescribing lots of different medications. As you know, most immediate care clinics are open extended hours and weekends when patients' primary care offices are not usually open. Many pharmacies are also not open during these extended hours. And so it's sometimes a burden for patients to try to get a prescription filled as they leave an immediate care clinic late at night. I know that over the years, there have been several instances where I've given a prescription to a patient only to find out that by the next day, they were still unable to get the prescription started. We're all interested in providing the best quality, affordable health care, and we know that we need to think outside the box and do things differently to meet the needs of the many patients seeking our help. Allowing non-physician
Thank
providers...
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlick, Chair Thompson, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Pratt. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Primary Care Association, representing over 162 clinics across the state of Oregon, serving 250,000 patients, vulnerable patients. And I simply want to register our support for this bill as well, particularly at a time when the workforce shortage is so severe. There's the need to extend as much capacity as possible to as many members of the provider community is essential. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry to force you to all be so brief. I think the issues are here, and we'll be able to take care of them, I think, quite clearly. Can I get Liz Hunchen and Jackson Leone, please? We'll give you 3 minutes each. Mr. Leone is my constituent. I should give him 3 minutes and 15 seconds.
Thank you, sir. We set to go. Well, thank you very much, Chairs Greenlick and Thompson, and to the committee members. To say really quickly, there's no shortage of pharmacists out there. We are out there and we are available. And I appreciate my colleagues, my constituents, people who spoke in front of you. We are a valuable healthcare member team. But what you don't know is I represent the Oregon Society of Consultant Pharmacists, the Oregon State Pharmacy Association, and the Oregon Healthcare Systems. So we have three of the major systems out there, and this is not good for patient safety. It's not good for patient safety because we as pharmacists, myself, have not advocated well on the part of pharmacy to tell people that we catch prescription prescribing errors on a daily basis. We are specialized in 3 to 4 years studying a special area to take care of every one of you, okay? And now we have someone that wants to come in with 2 classes, 75 hours of pharmacy knowledge to take care of you. If there was a reporting structure out there for us to be able to say to you, look at all the prescribing errors we have caught, you would be appalled by it. But we don't. We work with these colleagues. We bail them out. We let them know that we have a problem, and I caught it, and I'm here to make a difference. I'm not here to turn them in because we work together. It does no purpose to hurt people by taking away them and their licenses. It helps us by being able to make a point very clear. We care. We should work with each other. This bill, I urge you to oppose because it does not help take care of patients. It takes away the last check for you to be able to know that you are safe. There are things that are good, and a lot of times they will go through fine. But what about the one that doesn't? They're the ones who are going to bounce back in the system. They're the ones you're going to hurt. So for sake of time, I ask you to please look at the handout that you have, that you received from us. I want to comply because I know we're behind, but I do urge it. This is truly about patient care. It's about 75 hours versus 3 years to 4 years of practice. It's about us not telling on people. It's about us talking to the people who caused the mistakes. It's about us helping them. Computers don't work. The piece that we lost was our knowledge. Our knowledge is there to make a difference. The computers don't catch it. We catch things constantly. We tell the computer people who program, they don't work. And I'm thankful because that's job preservation, I guess. But I'd be more thankful that I make a difference in people's lives, and so do my fellow pharmacists. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You give me back a minute. Appreciate that.
No, I'll try and give you back a couple more. Co-Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson, it's very nice to see you today, and members of the committee, thank you for having us here. I'm speaking, my name is Lise Houchin. I'm the Northwest Regional Director for the National Association of Chain Drug Stores. I'm here in opposition to 2386. Just to echo some of the things that Jackson said, and I won't do a lot of that, but community pharmacists work very collaboratively with nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, and doctors, and we both support and respect their role in providing primary care through diagnosis and prescribing. Our concern is with the eliminating the check and balance, and as was said that I would say, with multiple dispensers. The state of Oregon has a program within your own Medicaid program that requires recipients to choose one pharmacy, and it's for a certain group of Medicaid recipients. That way, no matter how many prescribers the patient may see for various maladies, the patient's chosen pharmacy will coordinate the drug regimen, eliminating potential contraindications and misadventures with prescriptions and over-the-counter products. One of the things that I also wanted to bring up in terms of the Medicaid and Medicare, it's my understanding that this group of folks does not see Medicaid or Medicare recipients. So that's so it's more of a cash-paying group of customers. So we have a whole group of folks out there that would not have access to this care. Pharmacist education is extensive with over six
well,
years.
They might have access at one of the other clinics that people were talking
Pardon me?
About. It would be access at one of the other clinics that people were talking
no,
about.
No, they do not see Medicare and Medicaid clients.
Dream Care doesn't, but
correct.
Your testimony from the public, from the Primary Care Association and from Providence, there are other clinics.
I'm sorry, yes, sir. I was talking about Zoom Care. Thank you very much. I apologize. We're concerned with the lack of oversight also by the Board of Pharmacy, which is responsible for overseeing the dispensing of drugs and the accountability related to the drugs in stock. The Board also enforces extensive laws and rules that protect the public and when it comes to the dispensing of prescriptions in addition to the practice of pharmacy. We would appreciate your consideration of our comments and concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick. Would you support if they had just a narrow scope of antibiotics or things like that that they could prescribe? Would you support anything like that?
I would say that I cannot, and I can share with you an example, if I may, Representative Widener, is that I take care of approximately 12,000 people that are elderly, and I have special geriatric training, and so do my staff. And we commonly see an antibiotic that is prescribed on a regular basis, but what people oftentimes don't see is that when you're over 65, we all start, unfortunately, we don't get any better. We get worse. Our
careful
renal function
now.
Decreases.
Let's be careful, please.
Yeah. Not smart
no
to pick on
sir.
The chair.
Just checking.
No offense, sir.
And I agree.
But what I'm saying is that we catch these prescriptions for antibiotics that people think are simple drugs. And they can result in kidney function damage. They can result in serious things that send people back to hospital, potentially even die. And we all think that they're just drugs, but our pharmacists haven't helped you because we don't publicize and say that we're catching these issues. We call and we tell them, is this really the right dose? The computer won't tell you it's the right dose for an elderly person. It'll just tell you that this is okay. It's within normal limits. And that's what people have not seen out there. And that's what I'm trying to share with you, is that this is dangerous. So I would say that I could not support that because antibiotics are extremely dangerous. There are black box warnings that the FDA come out with that say, dangerous.
Is it not true that physicians can dispense now?
Physicians
medical
can.
Board?
Yes, they can.
So pharmacists, you don't worry about the fact that pharmacists, I mean, the errors you correct are errors of physicians. But physicians can dispense now under the medical board.
Yes, and nurse practitioners prescribe. So when people prescribe and they use pharmacists as checking
out. Physicians can currently dispense.
Yes, they do.
Those people who write those prescriptions that you correct can now dispense under the authority of the medical board. Is that?
And some of them who do not dispense also can prescribe, and those are the nurse practitioners and the physician's assistants. And we're just saying we should be check and balance. When a doctor prescribes, as you're saying?
No, I'm saying a doctor can dispense, right?
Yes, and prescribe.
About prescribe. Dispense. You're talking about all the errors you correct. Those errors are mostly errors of physicians. They're not mostly errors of physicians?
No, sir. They are also from physician assistants, and they're also from nurse practitioners who can prescribe. And when they prescribe and they go through the pharmacy,
so
we catch
you don't
them.
Ever correct any errors of physicians. Is that what you're
we
saying?
We do catch them, too. We
but
catch
they
them
can dispense, time. Right?
Yes, they can, sir.
And therefore, they can get by your...
They can, yes, sir.
That's all I wanted to check. And physician assistants are authorized to act under physicians.
Correct. Under this bill, yes.
I'm sorry, Representative Widener, I cut you off. I couldn't resist.
That he opened the door for us. So... You're saying you follow up with them. You're calling them to make sure, is that the right dose? So they're still making the determination there.
Yes, sir.
So if there were guidelines in place for them to check with another physician assistant or something at their own location, would you support it then if the guidelines were in place? So a nurse practitioner says, I want to give you 20 milligrams of amoxicillin, and then they just check with another physician, you think this is correct for this patient? At that facility, would you support the bill then if there was a check and balance in place like that?
If the check and balance was to another physician assistant, I would still have to say that I cannot because of the amount of training that they've had. 75 hours is what I just heard here. Two classes. I don't know if that's safe for people. I see that it isn't safe for people. And I'm trying to figure out what I'm hearing as you're asking is there a way to get around it? I don't know how to get around trying to take care of people, sir. I know that if you put the...
Can I ask you to have the last question? We've got business we need to do yet.
Sure. Just the real quick of it, you know, because when you go in the doctor and they, you know, and sometimes you see a physician's assistant, you know, and there's, like, samples and stuff. I mean, how does that not kind of tie into this conversation about what's being handed out at a doctor's office versus what's going to the pharmacy? Because I guess for me there's a convenience factor here in that I've got three kids. If I got to go schlep them to one place and then schlep them to the next place to chase all this down, I mean, is there a list at all of meds that's kind of an acceptable... I mean, I saw some of the things that, you know, we're potentially looking at under the generic names, and, you know, I'm not a pharmacist, but I could go through that list myself and tell you likely what you're giving it to me for, and that's just me as a consumer. So I'm just, you know, I'm kind of curious, you know, if they're saying non-narcotics and they're not prescribing mental health meds and some of these drugs, I mean, is 800 milligrams of a acetaminophen or Motrin or whatever, is that really, I mean, we got some concerns with that? Because I'm looking at that list and I'm like, that doesn't like freak me out as a consumer.
To help answer that, again, as a pharmacist, Tylenol can kill you.
Sure.
It's an over-the-counter product. And so when you ask the question, I'm sorry, am I out of time?
That's enough. That's a good place to end.
Okay.
Tylenol can kill you. We'll end there.
I don't want people to die.
Make sure they don't give out any Tylenol, please. We will close the hearing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Long. The hearing on, where are we? 2386. Thank you again. Sorry that it was such a cramped hearing on both sides. We'll be back on this one.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
If I may, I think Representative Kinnear probably would have appreciated Tylenol the other day.
He should aspirin, which was
aspirin.
I
took two aspirin, which is the correct thing to do.
He did the right thing. What?
81 milligrams.
Did the right thing. No, okay. Yeah. We're going to open a work session on 3137. Here's where we are. Let's replay the action on 3137. We have not even yet gone through the Dash 1 amendments we have in front of us, but what we have done is ask our co-chairs, our vice chairs, to look at what's happened in the Senate Bill 99 and in what we have before us in the Dash 1 amendments of 3137. And give us the issues that are relevant issues. And what I'm going to ask them to do in the 15 minutes we have, and however they want to handle it, is raise the issues we have, and at the next process in the work session, have us have a chance to talk over those issues one at a time, and perhaps have a panel of folks who want to testify before us on those issue-by-issue panels. Maybe we'll see if we can get two or three invited testimonies to talk to us about that. But Representative Cannon, Representative Kinnemer, do you want to take over the next 15 minutes and tell us where you think we are at the moment?
If I can start it out.
Sure.
I first of all would like to thank Representative Cannon and Christie on his staff for the vast majority of this document, and I appreciate his working in that. As you know, I was out of circulation for a few days, so I've added a little bit to one additional item, I think, and I appreciate the good work that was done. So why don't you proceed from there?
Thank you. So we've prepared a document, and I appreciate Representative Kinnemer looking it over and adding to it. That attempts to respond to the co-chair's directive that we identify points of potential controversy related to the exchange proposal. The starting point for this was the Dash 5 amendments of Senate Bill 99. So we describe here the five points that we have heard from folks may be points of concern, and I'm not going to, I don't know if it would be instructive to go over these in any detail. I will just indicate that the five include, one, the membership of the board. This is the issue that we spent some time on when we went over the Dash Ones to the bill in front of us. Number two, what sort of power the exchange will have to negotiate with carriers on rates. Number three, the role of what will be the role of insurance agents or brokers within the exchange. I would note That these are referred to as producers in the text of the bill. So if you're looking at the R-1s or Senate Bill 99s-5s, you're looking for producers, but it's describing the agents and brokers. The fourth issue we identified was what should be the base for the assessment on carriers. The Senate Bill 99 concludes that only carriers that have plans in the exchange should be assessed. There are some who would advocate that that assessment should be spread across all carriers, all plans, whether they're in the exchange or not. And number fifth relates to what, how choices within the exchange will be constrained by the exchange or expansive. So to what power will the exchange have to limit the number of qualified health plans? What should those limits be, if any? We've tried to prepare this in a perfectly neutral way. I don't know that we've succeeded, but our attempt was simply to describe how Senate Bill 99 treats the issue, that an impartial description of what we think the issue is, the sort of point of controversy, and then some potential changes for the committee to consider. And I'm sure this isn't an exhaustive list of directions for us to go. Okay. What's your pleasure?
Thank you for doing that.
You have a comment?
I think that's just a terrific one, and I think you know, within our abilities, it's fairly objective about what are the policy issues that we ought to have a discussion about.
I think it would be useful. We have a few minutes more if you just go into a little detail on them, and then we need to talk about scheduling time and things like that. But
do you want to try and get Lori?
No, I don't think we need to bother her just yet. I think the very next thing we need to do is to finish the dash ones, to ask Laurie to do that. We'll try and schedule time for Friday's meeting. See, I mean, we've got a pretty heavy schedule. And then talk about these issue by issue rather than trying to deal with them in the language of the bills. Senator Wyden?
Mr. Chair, I think going through this, too, it'd almost be nice to know where the chairs stand on everything as well. I mean, what are deal breakers, what are deal makers, things like that, so we can see where the consensus is going to happen and everything, because when we're going through this, we can talk about what we want, what we don't want, but there might be something where we can't come to an agreement on this at all, because we might be digging our heels in on an issue that neither one of us will budge on. So, and those are things that we need to know, and we can meet up individually or whatever we need to on that, and just see where things are at.
Well, Jim and I can comment separately on this, but what I think is very important, I'm not convinced Senate Bill 99 in the form it's in the Senate will get out of the Senate.
I don't think the Senate is either.
Yeah. I think we need a bill that both caucuses will feel comfortable with. Exactly the same issue we're going to talk about later today in the transformation. I'll be happy to tell you what I think are the issues, and I'll also be happy to say that I think if we can't get a bill, then we need to be prepared to wait for the federal exchange and do that. But I have a very small number of things that I think are absolutely critical. And I would say the most important thing to me is that we not constrain the exchange in advance of knowing what their business plan is. And I think Jim and I will talk about it. We sort of had the feeling that we ought to set them up and let them come back to us with a plan in perhaps in February. And I certainly think it would be useful not to constrain them. So my issue isn't should they have this constraint or this constraint. My issue is we ought to leave it open and see what's going on next time. I also have a strong opinion on agents, but we can talk about that.
Jim, well, I kind of agree with you. I'm not sure how much time it would take this week, if we had the time, to clarify correctly the answer to the issues. And starting with the board, I'm not so concerned about how many people are on it, but I'm a little bit concerned about telling the exchange who can't be on it. And there's a tendency in what's been done so far to say who can't be there. And I'm not sure this is the point at which we want to limit the kind of knowledge the board brings to bear Now, I understand conflicts of interest and those kind of things, but there was discussion in the Senate about whether or not to include an actuary. Well, if I start my own insurance company, I sure the devil want to hire an actuary.
Well, yeah, I want to hire him, but you may not want to put him on the board.
Right, but so I want to be very careful that we don't turn this into a bureaucracy where it's a collection of a whole bunch of people who know nothing about insurance setting up an insurance exchange, and we're going to get what we paid for. So I don't have a definition of it has to be this person, this person, this person, this person. I'm just cautious of saying it can't be these people. Maybe I'd like to hear more discussion on that. But why not those people, or why those people?
We're not the only ones, but I think what you're hearing is we don't have huge lines in the sand.
No.
Well, and that's, I mean, hearing Representative Thompson, it was a concern I had because the board became a huge issue. I didn't think it was going to be over on the Senate side. And to me, it needs to be flexible because there might be times where we need to have an IT person on that board, especially in the beginning of setting this up, somebody who knows how to handle data management and things like that. So
I think one of the issues we'll get, and there are some people who really care about the board, I think what we'll hear is what's the difference between a governing board and who ought to be on that as opposed to expertise that you hire first off. Mr. Kenner?
Yeah, I guess a couple of things following up on what you were suggesting, Mr. Chair, is, I'm thinking there's some modeling here out of 2009, of last session, where we began to put it in motion, but it had to evolve, and that's kind of what I would see, is I think this needs to come back for final form probably next, in our next special, our February session of next year. The other piece is I think as best I can read it, and it might be well to have a couple of other, and we will have lots of other people reading this document. I think that for the most part we've identified five policy topics. I don't know exactly where they go, and I know I have my own little thoughts. So, although it was interesting as we got to some of these thoughts over in the Senate hearings, I noticed my opinion changing as we discussed, and I think if I really like your proposal that we sort of have we approach it topic by topic. I'm not sure they're all in equal size. I don't know. Some of them might not take a long time, although you can really get bogged down about who's going to be on that board. And I think, absolutely, that's a pretty fundamental question. And as you go on through the other issues, what's going to be the role or non-role of brokers and agents? Well, that's going to be a fun topic. On the other hand, I think it's wonderful to talk it out and see where we are.
So, Kevin, you have something?
No, this is... This is helpful. I don't think all of these are... I think one problem we have at a meta level in the legislature is we have a tendency to treat every issue as sort of equally important. We try to give them all equal time. And so we, just in the way that we arrange our hearings, I think not every issue in here is equally important. Perhaps if the, chairs were able to identify a starting place that isn't necessarily number one, membership of the board, I realize that's significant. I agree it matters. But there are some... At least in number two, I think, the power of the exchange to negotiate a really fundamental question about what the role and purpose of an exchange is. And frankly, some of the other things may fall out from decisions related to that. I think we may be able to identify a priority, or you may be able to identify a priority ranking for how to take these on within our discussions.
My impression is in the Senate discussions that several of us sat in and listened, positions got hardened so quickly. And it's sort of like the world was coming to an end if it isn't this or that. I hope we can think about how to compromise some of these things, and maybe not the search of the perfect is, frequently the perfect is the enemy of the good.
I think the thing that makes it tough is some of the mandates that the feds have put on us, and
yes.
We're sitting here, we're stuck.
That's the frame we're in. Yeah.
And
they're giving us things that are almost no starters for us to deal with that we don't like, you know. To me, we should be encouraging people just to put health insurance. Well, to say you only get a tax credit if you buy out of the exchange, to me, is wrong. We should be offering it if you buy health insurance for your employees, period. It
would be very useful if we don't debate things we have nothing to say about.
Yeah, and those are the things that make me cringe when the Fed sends something our direction. And then the other thing is, we start this up, right now you're looking at them cutting the funds for all of this, so now we got it going, and now it's left in our laps, and are we going to continue the program, or are we going to let it die at that point?
I guess our options are only two, though. It's not whether we're going to have an exchange or not. It's going to be whether we have an exchange we design or whether we're going to be a part of the federal exchange. That is uncomfortable, but I think that's where we are. So, I mean, we can say, screw it, let's not try and get it right here. Let's see what happens when the feds come in on the assumption that they will or maybe they won't. And I suspect if we can't get something that's worth having, we may want to be prepared to do that.
Which that could be a reality. I mean, you got a lot of states fighting this, and there's going to be a lot of states, fine, you come in and do it, and they're going to make it fail on them.
Even the states that have suits to stop it are busy building their own exchange.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to. They want to take whatever degrees of freedom they can and build what they want and whatever makes sense. So, and we can probably do a better job than waiting for the federal exchange if we talk to each other and make sure we don't get too hung up on positions too early. We've got some time.
What kind of is a timeline, do you think?
Well, we have to pass any House bill by the Thursday the 20th of...
Thursday the 21st, but our meeting is Wednesday the 20th.
It's Wednesday the 20th. So our deadline is the 20th. Part of the question is this going to need to go to Ways and Means or not? Because there's some argument that since this is all federal money and the money won't be spent before we have another chance at it in February, that it may not have to go to Ways and Means. But if not, and we need to clarify that.
Yeah.
I heard two different positions. Our speakers have told us, as you heard, anything that has more than $10,000 in federal funds in it requires Ways and Means. This may not be expended. I mean, I'm not sure what. I think the Senate has a feeling that they can bypass Ways and Means. I'm not sure that's true. But anyway, the final date would be the 20th. So time's getting close.
Time is close.
We could probably get Lori Freeman to create us amendment pieces that deal with, I mean, if we said these are the five issues, there are some things in the development of that, of the next draft we need that the governor's staff has already made, you know, change this word to this word, some things like that, and we can benefit. They'll make that available to Lori. Already has that available. So the next time we get together, Friday, I hope we have some time to finish what's in the Dash 1 amendments and have Lori be ready to work with us. We'll have another meeting at 5:30.
We'll have to start Friday on the timer to make sure we get there.
Yeah, we'll decide where we want to go.
We have a full one. It must be Wednesday, Transformation Day.
Thank you all very much.
Why is everybody not there?
Did you also
have a restricted? I did. What was the work session on 3137?
I got that bill that I have, the breast reconstruction bill,
yes.
Has been
referred to us.